Thank you very much. Mr. Quaid.
Good morning. Paul Quaid on behalf of Real Party and Interest, Cody Wallace, with Kenneth Ward. First, this case does not present as a Cripps violation. If this court wants to dispose of this matter quickly and easily, I would cite to NRS 1.230(1) and the in the matter of Philip Dunleavy, 104 Nevada 784. That is a case, and its progeny has to deal with the disqualification of judges and the holding that a judge is presumed to be unbiased, and the burden is on the party asserting the challenge to establish sufficient factual grounds warranting disqualification. Those cases are controlling because of the fact this does not present with a Cripps violation. There is one matter that I want to discuss just briefly before we move on to the Cripps issues. First of all, there is an error in this case, and that is the in-chambers discussion between counsel and the court was not recorded. That is an error that this court has admonished trial courts on numerous times, and I'm sure we'll take this opportunity to admonish the court that all those type of discussions need to be held on the record. But that does not merit disqualification in this case. The question is whether or not Judge Rogers needs to be disqualified for his conduct in this matter. And regrettably, I didn't catch the fact that this does not involve a Cripps violation because we're not looking at a criminal defendant wishing to withdraw his plea after being coerced or pressured into entering a plea in this case. Here we have a seasoned attorney in Mr. Auer complaining that he felt pressured by the trial court, felt that the trial court's expressions during that in-chambers review expressed a bias. I disagree with that analysis, and I disagree with what Mr. Auer heard from Judge Rogers. That is part of the problem with there not being an in-camera, or excuse me, a record created of that judicial discussion in chambers.
Mr. Quaid, assuming we agree with you, this wasn't a Cripps violation for the reasons Justice Pickering stated. Is it proper, though, under the separation of powers argument Mr. Auer made, that for the judges to come in here and say you should drop this, you should sentence to this? I mean, that's not really the judge's role. Isn't that the state's role to determine what should be charged? And the judge is neutral, and the judge deals with the sentencing if and when it gets to that stage, then.
And I understand the court's concern in that. I don't believe Cripps is a bright line rule because, of course, we don't have Federal Rule 11. Judges are allowed to participate in negotiations related to the sentencing issues. I actually prefer the Stanley case, the predecessor to Cripps, and I believe this court should go back to the Stanley case for several reasons. One being a separation of powers issue. As this court has held previously, one of this court's primary objectives is to promote the efficient administration of justice, Kramer versus PV 116, Nevada 575. Part of that goes to the trial court's role in making sure cases get moved forward. This case is a perfect example of a matter that I agree with Judge Rogers that this thing should have been resolved a long time ago. And the judges, in my view, should be allowed to express their opinion, particularly in a case where opening arguments have been had, where witnesses are presented, where there's numerous pretrial motions in this matter, that boys, you know, attorneys, parties, you need to get together and resolve this issue. I don't believe that that impinges upon the executive's authority to move forward in the case. This is a perfect example of this. Mr. Auer chose, on behalf of the Lyon County District Attorney's Office, to offer a second-degree murder, which was rejected, and now we're moving forward with the litigation in this matter.
Mr. Quaid.
Yes.
I'm not sure that this case implicates Cripps as previously discussed, other than the fact that the discussion related to sentencing. Focus here should be, in my view, on whether the judge's conduct created some appearance of impropriety justifying his or her disqualification, his in this case. What would your position be had the judge brought counsel in and said, I can't believe that first-degree murder wasn't charged in this case. This is an outrage. And this time and effort was devoted to this case, and this person should spend the rest of their life in prison. Would the defense seek the judge's disqualification under such circumstances?
It's interesting that you raise that, because I stand in a position as a defense attorney where I'm usually complaining about the judicial involvement, but I want to use an example of a case that was passed on by this court, the Gary Rosales matter. I happened to be trial counsel during the first proceedings in that case. We engaged in negotiation with the special prosecutor related to that matter. And as a matter of fact, related to the negotiations in that case, and in the first ruling of this court, the court found a Cripps violation and reversed the plea. I asked for judicial involvement on behalf of my client. I approached the court. So I share in that Cripps violation in that case. I knew it was in my client's best interest to resolve that case. My client didn't understand that fact. He didn't know what the risks were. He understands now because we obtained a plea agreement and a sentence with an 8-year minimum initially on that case. This court reversed that matter because of the Cripps violation by Judge Kosach, and thereafter, Mr. Rosales chose not to enter in a plea agreement and to go to trial. After trial in that matter, his sentence was approximately 30 years on the bottom end. And to answer your question in that regard, there's a reason I stand beside my client. Sometimes my clients, because they are compromised, either intellectually, because of being drug-addled, substance abuse-addled, I stand there to protect him. Perhaps I'm the stubborn, difficult defense attorney that can stand up to most judges' entreaties and pressures and will advise my client accordingly, but I think that you need to give defense counsel a little more credit related to the wisdom of proceeding to trial or proceeding to take a plea agreement depending on the facts and presentation of the case. So while you will see complaints about the judge engaging in pressures on the defendant. Two things there. The record should reflect that, and this court should have a decent record, whether it be in court or in chambers, related to the statements of the judge in pressuring resolution, and can make that determination. Number two, as far as that is concerned, I understand the court's wanting a bright line rule that makes this court's job easier, but I believe it makes the trial court's job much harder when you have that uncertainty, when you don't have that surety. I, as defense counsel, want to know what the judge's inclinations are in resolving the case. I look at the federal system where I practice regularly. It is very frustrating as defense counsel and often for the prosecution that we can't go and actually talk to the judge and figure out whether or not that plea is going to be accepted by the court. Any recommendations made as far as sentencing are going to be accepted by the court. I'm sure the justices remember the 174 plea where we could bind the court that's been legislatively removed many years ago. But it created surety where we knew where we were going with the resolution of the case, and I believe that's why you've reserved that right of the trial court to express their opinions regarding the resolution of or the sentencing recommendations. I would also like to use an example of in California, which allows judicial involvement. And in fact, in California, where I practice, we sit down with the trial court in chambers and go through each one of the cases presented that day. There are discussions amongst the attorneys, and the judge renders an opinion. This is in a small county, Plumas County, Lassen County, and I would like the justices to also consider the smaller counties in the state where often the parties are known, the circumstances are known. And there are discussions that go beyond maybe the exact facts of that particular case as to how we're going to resolve this defendant's case for the betterment of the community. And that's really where Judge Rogers was going. He was absolutely right. There needed to be closure in this case, not only for the benefit of Mr. Wallace, but also for the benefit of the family, for the benefit of the community, and the remarkable amount of money that was spent on this matter, particularly when it was a death penalty case. So to say that the judge should not be able to express his opinion about these issues, I think really ties the hands of the trial court judges and makes their job so much more difficult in trying to resolve these matters, Gary Rosales being a perfect example of a case that should have been resolved by plea, which it was, appropriate sentence meted out. Thereafter, you want to talk about expenditure of judicial resources in conducting that trial, putting a second special prosecutor was appointed. The matter went to trial, numerous witnesses, lengthy trial, and then a lengthy sentence. And so when you look at it from that perspective, as far as the involvement of the judiciary, you got to put some trust in the attorneys to take their licks, take the pressure from the judiciary, in its administration of its court calendar, the efficient administration of justice, and make decisions on behalf of whether or not they're going to prosecute a case or whether or not a criminal defendant is going to proceed to trial on that matter. Any other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
I take it, Mr. Quaid, in your argument, you don't take exception then with what was said in the off-record conversation.
I don't. I think that they were appropriate observations under the circumstance of the situation. Even if I did, and I thought the judge was pressuring me, I knew the facts of the case. I'm ready to go to trial now, and I believe we'll obtain an acquittal in that case. I did not want to ask for a mistrial. So I'm going to make those determinations, convey those concerns, considerations to my client, but also give my client independent advice, particularly in the facts of this case, where my client does have some deficiencies, where he's going to rely on his counsel to make good decisions for him and give him good direction.
So based on your argument, it does seem that even you walked away from that conversation with the point of view that the judge was trying to influence the outcome of the case.
No. Let me strike that. I think he made valid observations as to a resolution of a criminal matter. I have to change my immediate answer and say, I believe he was trying to influence the outcome of the case. I don't believe the sentence was a final determination, and I wholeheartedly disagree with Mr. Auer as far as what the judge indicated what the sentence was going to be. But I do believe after seeing the pretrial motions, opening arguments, and one witness, partial witness, that the judge made some astute observations as to finishing this case up and not going through a full 4-week plus jury trial.
Let me ask this question. Now that you've said that you agree with Counsel Mr. Auer about what was said in the chambers and the fact that Judge Rogers was trying to influence the outcome of the case, you're saying there's no Cripps violation?
No, because it just presents with a different circumstance. And here we have to make a determination, in my view, of whether or not Judge Rogers should be disqualified because he demonstrated bias or prejudice against one of the parties, which I don't believe he did at all. And that's a clarification I'd make to Justice Hardesty's opinion. Yes, influence, resolution of the case, demonstrating bias or prejudice against Lyon County District Attorney's Office in this matter. I completely disagree, and I disagree with the assertion that Judge Rogers would do anything in his power to meet that end of what he expressed was a reasonable resolution. And that goes to any facts that demonstrate actual bias or prejudice in this case.
If we do find a Cripps violation, are you asking us to overrule Cripps or to modify Cripps or to clarify Cripps under these facts?
I would like to see a reversion to the Stanley standard that Cripps partially overruled that gives the trial courts additional leeway to participate in negotiations.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wade, Mr. Auer, you have just under 3 minutes left.
I'll talk fast, Your Honor. First, I'm going to quote from Mr. Quaid's answer to my motion to disqualify, his answer. Second, even assuming inappropriate and coercive conduct on the part of Judge Rogers in promoting settlement, there was no plea negotiation in this case. Both parties considered their options and walked away from the negotiations. In fact, the prosecution's generous offer of murder in the second degree was and will continue to be rejected by defendant Cody Wallace as he maintains his innocence. So it's a little disingenuous for counsel to say the case should be settled when the counsel said he wants trial and his client maintains his innocence.
Was there a Cripps violation here?
To me, Cripps is the equivalent of Federal Rule 11. I may be wrong about that. But if it is, then it applies whether the case is in progress or whether the case is after the case is over during post-conviction. It still creates a problem for this court. Because let's assume that the defendant accepted the offer of the second-degree murder and then later on came back in post-conviction and said, well, no, I shouldn't. I was forced into the second-degree murder. I was pressured by the judge. Now that's a Cripps violation. So it's our position that the same Cripps is like Rule 11. It applies throughout the proceeding. The other point I want to get back to, Your Honor.
Let me just ask this question real quick.
Is
it time for us to modify or to clarify Cripps? Isn't it time for this court, since some of us were not there when Cripps was decided, to modify
wholeheartedly
it, to clarify?
Because to me, the language is extremely broad and expansive. And I think the judge's conduct clearly falls into the broad and expansive language of the bright line rule, prohibition. Judge thought what he did only amounted to harmless error.
Want to extend Cripps, because Cripps had limited application.
Yes, Your Honor. And also, I want to get back to Justice Hardesty's point of really what we're talking about here is a violation of the rules of the canons of ethics. Rule 2.2, a judge shall uphold and apply the law and perform his duties fairly and impartially. 2.6, a judge shall accord every person who has a legal interest in the proceeding or that person's lawyer the right to be heard according to law. It's our position that we were not allowed to be heard. And then there's the part in that rule that talks about coercion. There was no second degree offer before trial. It was coerced. That's our position. Finally, a judge shall disqualify himself in any proceeding in which the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned.
Justice Pickering has a question.
Yes.
I'm glad you got to Rule 2.11 because I have a question about subparagraph 5 of Rule 2.11, which addresses the issue of a judge making comments that appear to demonstrate that he cannot be or she cannot be impartial. But they suggest that the judge is certainly free to make that expression in the context of the proceeding itself. It says, as a grounds for disqualification, the judge, while a judge or judicial candidate, has made a public statement, and I emphasize, other than in a court proceeding, that commits or appears to commit the judge to reach a particular result or rule. So, and in civil litigation, you will find judges that say to you, I don't think much of your tort claims. Why aren't you trying a contract case, for example? That's perfectly fine, and I would be surprised if people were taking exception to that. The judge I worked for used to say things like that all the time. it's because of Cripps and Cripps' condemnation of the judge's involvement in the criminal plea negotiation that you're even here with that. Because when a judge declines to give jury instructions that you want or says there's no evidence of the defense that's being put forward, that judge is entitled to shape the proceeding going forward, and that's certainly what Rule 2.11 recognizes. So if you didn't have Cripps, would you have a basis for disqualification?
I think I read this subparagraph a little bit differently than you do, and it's because of the words public statement. I think really what that's talking about is a public statement. Hey, I think Auer's case isn't worth a damn. That's not what happened here. This was a private statement, and it was private on purpose, and there was no record made on purpose. This judge knew what he was doing when he brought us in there right before he ruled on the mistrial motion. There was no record made of this on purpose. He went right back onto the record at 9 o'clock after this little non-reported meeting happened. This judge didn't put this little meeting on the record on purpose. So, Mr. Justice Pickering, this is, to me, not a public statement.
Counsel, you harpen on that word on purpose. If I'm understanding what was being said, this is, we have a jury trial, we have a jury that's been sworn there. Sitting there, possibly the court didn't want his opinion getting back to a sworn jury that might influence them. Is that not possible?
There's a canon.
Is it possible?
I don't know, Your Honor. I know that has a canon that says he's not supposed to do anything during the trial that would influence
him. I understand that. I guess the other question, and you talked about separation of executive branch and judicial branch. So from your standpoint, you would have, in essence, cut off all contact or all comment between the bench and counsel, even the blessing of, say, a negotiated agreement between the state and the defense, where you're brokering something that you think is in the state's best interest in a number of years in the defense, and you're trying to see if the court will accept that and be bound by that. Would that extend to your analogy?
That's not this case.
I understand that, but I'm asking you the question.
You left a little narrow exception, to me narrow, in Cripps.
Well, first, before you get there, would you answer my question opposed to posing another question?
And I think I'm trying to, in that if the parties came to the judge, if the parties came to the judge and said, hey, judge, we know we're in trial, but we want to resolve this. That happens in jury trials. You know, we've done 4 days of trial, but now we want to enter into a deal and we run it past the judge. There's a little bit of language in Cripps that says that's an exception to the broad and expansive language of Cripps that makes that okay for the judge to do that. That's not what happened here.
Is the judge then limited when you broach what you think the sentence should be? If the judge looks at it and says, well, I think another year should be added or a year should be subtracted, or does the judge just have to say yes or no?
Here, the judge suggested the sentence.
Well, I'm not dealing with that. I'm dealing with the hypothetical I'm giving you.
I think that there's a narrow exception in Cripps that if the parties come to the judge with a potential settlement, that the judge can bless it or not bless it. That's already there.
He's not allowed to counter. He would not be allowed to counter offer, either way, up or down.
You know, Your Honor, that's a slippery slope.
I understand that. That's why I'm asking you the question based on some other hypothetical.
The language that you have right now in Cripps, he would not be allowed to counter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Auer. Mr. Quay, your excellent arguments and briefs, and this case will stand.